Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, welcome to the LSE, to this event this evening. My name is Aaron Reeves, and I'm a professor of sociology at the Department of Sociology here at the LSE. It's wonderful to be able to see a few of you here this evening, and I know more will be coming. So before kind of formally introducing our speakers this evening, allow me to do maybe just a little bit of housekeeping and say first, we just remind you to put your phones on silent for us. The event is being recorded, and I think will be made available at some point later if technical difficulties don't arise in the meantime. There'll be a chance to ask questions at the end. We'd really welcome those and be keen to have you pose the questions that you have to the panel. So just please raise your hand. I think a steward will come round and share a microphone with you, and we'll try and get as many questions as we possibly can through the evening. So it's my pleasure to introduce Julian Goh this evening, first of all. Julian is a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. Professor, among other appointments, but I'll maybe just focus on that. But Professor Goh research explores, among related questions, the social logics of empire and colonialism. His work is critical in insisting that we cannot understand the modern world, its politics, its institutions, its knowledge systems, without reckoning seriously with empire. And part of what I think I personally find inspiring about his work is that in pursuing these questions, he's committed to carefully building these arguments, doing the hard work of establishing connections and mechanisms. And in, I think, you know, my view is that Professor Goh recognised that making these arguments is too important to do in a haphazard way. And much of his scholarship has focused on the US empire, but today we'll hear a bit about his reflections on his book, I think kind of policing empires, drawing on that work. Policing empires, militarization, race, and the imperial boomerang in Britain and the United States. We also are really lucky to have, from our sociology department, Marwish Ahmed, who is assistant professor in human rights and politics and a co-director of the LSE Human Rights Program. Her work charts how seemingly disconnected practices of violence and revolt are entangled across history, geography, and social life. Drawing on ethnographic work of violence, anti-colonial histories, and South Asian studies, she's especially interested in methods that unearth surprising links between destructive techniques and political struggles that, at first glance, look completely unrelated. So I think we're really lucky to have both of our speakers. We're really grateful to them. We're going to first hear from Julian before Marwish kind of offers some reflections on that, and then we'll open up to you, the audience. If you do want to kind of participate in online, you can use hashtags LSE events, and maybe also just a big plug for a major event that's coming up over the next couple of months, I think, which is LSE Festival. The kind of theme of that is how to save the planet. We would really encourage people to sign up, to come along for the events. There's a range of really exciting speakers, including Mariana Mazzucato and Nish Kumar, among others, who will be announced in the near future. So if you are inclined, please do sign up. But before we kind of deal with all of that, let's first join me in welcoming Professor Goh.
So thank you, Aaron, for that introduction. And I want to thank Aaron also for organizing this, and the LSE events team for organizing this, and Marwish for participating. It's really great to be here. As hopefully will be clear by the end of my talk, my lecture is something of an exercise in postcolonial sociology. I can talk about what that means later in Q&A if you want. But I want to begin by talking about something that may not seem related to postcolonial thought, and that is fascism or authoritarianism. Now, scholars will tell us a lot about the variants, the various ideological, economic, and political components of fascism and authoritarianism. What I've been thinking about is the role of militarism in fascist or authoritarian regimes. For regardless of all other factors, one of the crucial preconditions, I'd argue, for a fascist regime is a militarized state. That is a state where law enforcement rests in the hands of a powerful police that is heavily armed and functions as an occupying army, a police that has the capacity to violently suppress dissent, surveil populations, and control them with threats of force. We could argue about whether or not we are heading towards or living under fascist regimes in our liberal democracies today. But what's indisputable, it seems to me, is that we, in the Anglo-American world, in our officially liberal democratic states, we're already living under heavily militarized police with the infrastructural capacity for authoritarian rule. We see this, of course, recently in militarized police forces that have suppressed pro-Palestinian protests. In the US, from big cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, to New York, to even the smallest college towns like Amherst, Massachusetts, what we've seen are student protesters being shut down by hundreds of heavily armed police in military dress and riot gear, brandishing military-grade assault weapons and tear gas. We also saw this militarized police in the US during the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, the protests in Standing Rock, and in Ferguson in 2014, cases where protesters were met not only by police with assault rifles and tear gas, but also rubber bullets and tanks or mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles. And of course, most recently in the US, we've seen immigration and customs enforcement units called ICE dressed and armed like deadly Marines, and even deploying their weapons against innocent civilians. Now, to be clear, none of this is restricted to the US. The British police, too, are heavily militarized. Now, of course, the British police are not as armed as the American police, but this doesn't mean the British police aren't armed. The sociologist Stuart Hall noted this long ago. Indeed, the British police have armed units, undergo military-grade training, use military surveillance technologies like drones, and often share the mindsets and mentalities of military units. Recent reports here in the UK have noted this trend as deeply troubling, to say the least. Meanwhile, the UK has been seeing what the Institute of Race Relations not only calls hyper-militarized policing, but also militarized border control. In short, we have seen in our liberal democratic nations what the sociologist Peter Kraska calls the militarization of policing, which is defined as the process whereby civilian police increasingly draw from and pattern themselves around the tenets of militarism and the military model. And what's crucial here is that it involves not just the adoption of, you know, military weaponry, like not just the material stuff, but the cultural and organizational and operational aspects of the military as well. And what this means, again, is that the police bear the arms and mindsets of armies ready to treat citizens as enemies of war, as foreign aggressors. It also means that our so-called liberal democracies already have the material infrastructure for fascist, authoritarian, or dictatorial rule. The authoritarian trigger just needs to be pulled. Now, all of this, of course, should be frightening, but it's also puzzling. And what's puzzling about it is that if you know about the history of the police in the UK or the US, you'll know it's really not supposed to be this way. Policing as we know it today is supposed to follow the model of the civil police. This is a model of policing that originated here in Britain, in London, in 1829, when Sir Robert Peel created the London Metropolitan Police, the first professional, centralized, uniform police department in all of England. And the model of the Met subsequently spread to the US, where cities also created their own police departments. And this new form of policing, the civil police, was meant to be, an alternative to the use of the army. In fact, Peel invented the model and implemented it in England as a new state organization to fight crime and social disorder without having to use the coercive tools of the military, thereby generating the bifurcation between policing and the army that we kind of take for granted today. That is, the army is supposed to be for violent coercion on enemies overseas, while the police are for domestic populations. In this regard, the term civil police is especially fitting. The word civil, of course, invokes the citizen, as in a police force of, by, and for citizens, rather than for foreigners and enemies. It likewise summons the sense of civility, hence peace, rather than brute force, as these images presented by the London Metropolitan Police on their website try to convey. But again, by militarization, the civil police transgress this stated ideal. The police and the military are more and more alike rather than different, such that citizens become enemies of war, or at best, potential subjects of fascist regimes. So this sets up the main question I want to ask. Basically, how and why? That is, how and why exactly have the civil police become militarized? Or to put it more bluntly, how and why have our liberal democracies created militarized states readied for authoritarian rule overnight? How did we get here? Now, to answer, I'll draw upon my recent book, Policing Empires, where I excavate the history of police militarization in Britain and the United States from their founding in the 19th century to the present. This is a work of historical sociology. I'm a sociologist, after all. But I also firmly believe that understanding our present requires a careful, rigorous, and critical understanding of the past. What is needed, in other words, is a critical history of the present. And I hope that those of you who aren't so historically minded will see the value of historical sociology by the end of my talk. And through this analysis, I will end up telling a story that differs from dominant accounts of policing that we might hear across the Atlantic and even here in London. The first has to do with historicization. Most accounts of policing suggest that the civil police became militarized in recent years, something that happened in the past decades, or maybe in the 90s. By contrast, I find that the so-called civil police in both Britain and the US have been militarized from the very beginning of modern policing, and that this has been a continual, repeated process. More precisely, since the beginning of modern policing, there have been multiple moments when the police have borrowed materials, tactics, and templates from the military, different waves of militarization historically. The second overarching claim is that these waves of militarization manifest deeper logics. These are logics, as we'll see, that have to do with things that most accounts of policing, with notable exceptions, have not taken seriously enough, and that is empire. My claim is that to understand police militarization, and I'd even argue the very essence and character of policing today, we need to understand policing's deep racialized imperiality, or more simply, its coloniality. And with this, what I'll ultimately argue is that police militarization, the word police militarization, is probably not the best way to think about this. What we call militarization, I claim, should be better conceptualized as an effect of the imperial boomerang. So what I'll do in the rest of my talk, I will unpack these points. The way I'll do so is by looking at different waves of policing. And I'll start with the formation of the London Metropolitan Police in 1829 and then bring us up to the present. Now, first, the London Metropolitan Police. To understand the importance of this, you really have to recognize how new of an organization it was. Before this time, policing as we know it did not exist. The word police did not refer to an institution or a department so much as an act or function of government. And it often referred to regulating the economy, not crime. And there were no police departments, as we know of them today. To deal with crime, London and all of England had only a motley array of watchmen and local parish constables, many of whom were part-time, volunteer, or paid by fees. Citizens, not the state, were supposed to regulate themselves. And to deal with social disorders, such as strikes that got out of control or social protests that got out of control, the English state had to call in the army. The new police of London changed all of that. It brought a centralized, full-time, professionalized, uniformed police that was tasked with tackling crime and regulating public order at once. And this is exactly why it is apt, in a certain sense, to refer to this new police as the civil police, because it was meant to replace the army and be a force of civilians under civilian control, aimed at crime prevention as well as maintaining social order. And this model was crucial, widely influential. It's the model that spread all around England and then came over to the US. And by now, it's the model that sort of dominates all police departments, this idea of a centralized, full-time, uniformed police. But what about militarization? Well, on the one hand, the London Police, as I just said, was partly meant as an alternative to the army, right? In England, calling in the army to deal with strikes and major protests had become far too onerous and dangerous. Think about what happened at Peterloo. So officials began contemplating an alternative, right? And one of the officials who founded the London Police and who was among these reformers was Sir Robert Peel, the Home Secretary of Britain. And he initially considered creating a French-style gendarmerie for England, which in France was a sort of national military police controlled by the military. The problem was that Peel knew this wouldn't fly. His upper-class friends, the rising middle classes, and the public more generally was jealous of their liberties. And if there's anything they hated, it was French-style militarism and the use of the army on sacred home ground. So Peel had to create something new, right? Like an alternative to a gendarmerie on the one hand, and no coercive force at all. And what he ended up doing was creating this model of the civil police. But here's the issue. While this model of the civil police was crafted as an alternative to the army, it was nonetheless militarized from the outset. The new police, in fact, borrowed not so much from the military per se, but more precisely from colonial forms of control. Now, it's typically noted that Peel, who founded the new police, had had colonial experience. He had previously served as chief secretary of Ireland, essentially its colonial governor. But what's important is that the forms of colonial coercion that he and others had helped devise there in Ireland were really the inspiration for what he did here in England. Now, to understand this, you have to remember in Ireland, there had been a number of different coercive forms of state to regulate the colony. Long before the London Police of 1829, there had been, for example, the Dublin Metropolitan Police, a heavily armed urban counterinsurgency force whose duties were exactly to control crime and manage public order. Then in 1814, over a decade before he created the London Police, Peel himself created what he called the Peace Preservation Force to cover some of the rural districts. And this Peace Preservation Force eventually merged with the 1822 Irish Constabulary, later renamed the Royal Irish Constabulary. Most of the constabulary's officers were veterans of the army, and the structure of the force followed the army's hierarchy. They were regularly drilled and trained in military methods. They were heavily armed, bearing pistols and bayoneted carbines, and they were housed in barracks to be called out as needed. These then were all counterinsurgency police forces, separate from the army, but they were heavily armed. They were tools of the colonial state to suppress anti-colonial dissent, to suppress anti-colonial unrest, and also attend to criminality. And it's these colonial forces that really served as the model for the London Metropolitan Police. Peel simply transferred them to English soil with some slight modifications. So for instance, the constable and watch system had been completely decentralized, but Peel centralized the new police, putting it under the command and control of the Home Office, which meant putting it under control of himself in the Home Office. And this was exactly the system of centralized policing that he had created in Ireland. Furthermore, just as Peel's constabulary in Ireland had been organized along military lines with officers, non-commissioned officers, and men, so did Peel structure the London police in the same way. In fact, Peel insisted that the new London police be commanded by commissioners not just with military experience, but specifically with experience where? In Ireland. One commissioner was this guy who he appointed, Charles Rowan, who had been not only in the military, but also had served in Ireland. And in turn, Rowan worked with Peel to basically create this new system of operations and this new police force, and he drew upon his own in-depth colonial experience. For instance, Rowan and Peel together structured the force according to a military hierarchy. Beneath Rowan were a series of other police officers, including 16 sergeants, a title taken directly from the army. This is, you know, we take the military hierarchy, the military structure of police completely for granted today. But this was a creation, and it was a creation of the London Metropolitan Police, and it was modeled after the Irish forces. The new police was also uniformed, right? This too was a brand new thing. The constables and watches had not been uniformed. Many of the senior officers, furthermore, were taken directly from the military. And on top of this, the entire system of police patrol had a colonial inspiration. Each of the new police divisions were to be patrolled by constables operated according to the beat system. This is a familiar term we have today, the beat system. Policemen of each section are assigned to a specific territory or beat that they were to survey. And while this is a common term today, in fact, it was the London police who originated it, but the London police had simply taken it from the colonies. It was essentially a mingling of two models of colonial coercion. First, it took from the slave patrols that had originated in the British Caribbean and the Carolinas. These had been created for inspecting slave dwellings for arms or illicit goods, disrupting any large gatherings of slaves, hunting fugitives, and generally keeping slaves in line. Slave patrols had been organized into territorial districts to be surveyed. Those districts were called beats. The Met's new beat system combined with these, the British Army's new light infantry units. These were highly mobile counterinsurgency units that Charles Rowan's commander in the army, Sir John Moore, had developed and used against slave rebels in St. Lucia in the 1790s, and then used again in 1798 to rout the Irish insurgents during the 1789 rebellion. Light infantry were also essentially what Peel's Peace Preservation Force and the Irish Constabulary were also. Highly mobile, small units utilizing open order formations rather than close order formations. These colonial operations then were what informed Rowan's beat system. Assigned distinct territories that they were to cover, the new police patrols surveyed populations as slave militia patrols surveilled slave populations in their territories. But as the patrols were also meant to be flexible so that they could move across swaths of territory swiftly and mutually supporting and coming to each other in times of aid, they also mimicked Moore's light infantry and with them Peel's Peace Preservation Force and the Irish Constabulary. So there's many of our other examples. What I'm getting at here is that the police, despite the word civil police, was militarized from the get-go, and more precisely, that it drew upon colonial regimes of coercion. And in this sense, I do think the term police militarization is not as precise as it should be. Yes, the London Metropolitan Police borrowed military operations and forms, but it more precisely borrowed from colonial modalities of coercion. So rather than militarization, what we really have with the founding of the police is the coloniality of policing. While police militarization is just about appropriating military tools and practices generally, the coloniality of policing highlights the appropriation of the tools, tactics, technologies, and mindsets developed and deployed at the frontiers of empire to violently repress deviance and disorder from racialized populations deemed other and inferior. And what the coloniality of policing alerts us to is that militarization is essentially a product of the colonial boomerang, whereby the tools of empire are brought back home for domestic use. Now let me dwell on this concept boomerang for a moment. It's a concept that multiple scholars have used, such as Michel Foucault, in one of those rare moments where he actually acknowledges colonialism existed. In his lectures, Society Must Be Defended, he mentions this boomerang effect of his colonial tools coming home. Other scholars, like Hannah Arendt, use the term too in her book Origins of Totalitarianism. But long before Foucault, before Arendt, it was the Martinican anti-colonial thinker Aimé Césaire who named it originally. Césaire used the term to characterize Hitler's violent invasion and rule of neighboring European countries, claiming that what Hitler was doing in Europe was merely the importation of the processes and practices of European colonialism abroad that had been going on for centuries. And before Césaire, in the 1930s, the anti-colonial Pan-Africanist George Padmore spoke of something similar. He didn't use the exact term boomerang effect, but he did speak about what he called colonial fascism. He reported on how the British military and police in the British colony of Trinidad and Tobago were suppressing the right of colonized peoples to organize and strike through the use of violent suppression. And he warned that British fascist movements and fascism in Europe generally were doing the same thing. And I think both Césaire and Padmore hit the mark here. After all, keep in mind, the colonies and the peripheries of empire everywhere have typically not only been the site of brutal violence and repression, but also a kind of laboratory for modern repression. The space where imperialists developed novel forms of coercion, novel tools, technologies, and tactics of policing and militarism, and are free to use them on colonized populations, all justified on the grounds of racial difference. When you research colonialism, you'll see that colonial officials typically believe that they had to use violence and had to invent new coercive tools on colonized populations because, ostensibly, violence is all colonized peoples understand. Non-white peoples in the colonies or imperial peripheries were too irrational and emotional, too underdeveloped, too biologically inferior to understand law and to submit to law. They only understand the language of force, as Fanon points out. And what I'm arguing is that policing in Britain and in the US reflects the importation of these colonial forms. This is the return of the imperial boomerang to essentially create policing. Now, that said, there's one more crucial part to this story of the boomerang effect. And this is the second part of my argument today, the logics that summon the boomerang home. What are the historical conditions under which the tools and tactics of empire come back and are imported for domestic use? And in fact, Césaire, Padmore, Foucault, they don't really theorize this. At most, they would have to assume that it happens in exceptional situations when you have the rise of fascist leaders like Hitler or Mussolini, who find importation useful. But what I find is that the boomerang returns in more subtle ways than just the rise of exceptional evil leaders, that they are brought back by everyday policing officials and political elites. And the logic behind it all has to do with racialization. And by understanding this, we can get to an answer for why the civil police are militarized. So let me talk about this. Return to the story of the London Metropolitan Police. If you read the histories in standard historiography of why Peel created the London Metropolitan Police and why other cities created it, you'll see that they talk about, well, there was a crime wave, that there was a lot of strikes, and they were fearful of workers' protests and a lot of dissent, and so they had to create this new police. This is true, but what these standard historiographies miss is that this crime, or this perceived crime, and this perceived social disorder were racialized at the time. What Peel and other officials were responding to when they created the police was not so much crime and disorder in general, but rather the specific perceived threat posed by colonial peoples who had been migrating to England's urban centers. And in England at the time, this meant the Irish. Of course, the Irish had been coming to England for as long as the English rule had begun, but the early 1800s, just before the birth of the new police, saw heightened migration to England, even before the so-called Great Famine. The Union, as never before, facilitated England's colonization of Irish agriculture, a project which in turn ejected thousands of dispossessed, displaced, and destitute Irish subjects, a veritable colonial reserve army of the unemployed. At the same time, the rising cotton manufacturing and shipping industries in England required more cheap labor, and the Irish eventually filled the gap. In England, the numbers of Irish rose from 40,000 in the 1780s to 590,000 by 1831. And the influx of Irish populations fueled all kinds of anxieties among the English, who began complaining about the so-called Irish hordes. The migration further fueled long-standing processes of racialization. The Irish were increasingly seen as fundamentally foreign, unalterably alien, and incorrigibly inferior. While scientific racism had yet to take full hold, references to biology, blood, and stock increased in the first half of the 19th century, mingling with religious and cultural explanations of Irish inferiority. Stark differentiations between Irish workers and English workers followed, as countless so-called experts and officials and employers claimed that the Irish were physically predisposed to certain types of labor, were less civilized than English workers, were more disorderly and more violent than English workers, and this justified their low pay and their low position. The Irish, in short, were the racialized subproletariat of England's rising industrial economy. And what all of this meant is that when Peel and other police reformers, beginning in the 1820s through the 1830s, spoke about needing some kind of new police to deal with rising crime and disorder, they were really talking about the Irish. They saw the Irish as inherently lawless and criminal, and most officials blamed the Irish for the seeming increases in crime in urban centers. They also connected Irish migrants to the increased potential for uprisings in London and around the manufacturing districts of the country. And these perceptions simply continued the perceptions the English had long had of their Irish colonial subjects, seeing them as inherently violent, irrational, and prone to crime. And now in the 1820s, to the English mind, the barbarians were at the gates. And indeed, as many migrant Irish had joined the working workers' rebellions across England, they were seen as not only at the gates, but as flooding through them. In 1828, a Quarterly Review article blamed crime on the Irish while also predicting outright rebellion. The Irish conspirators of 1798 were sending their men to England, this article claimed, to incite English workers and were acting as the Guy Fawkesites of Ireland, plotting to make a glorious bonfire of London. Even black radicals were added to the threat as the press seized upon the fact that William Cuffy, an English worker of African origin, had become a leading figure in the Chartist movement, and the London press and officials began complaining that the London workers' Chartist movements were not in fact an English movement, but essentially an Irish movement led by an African. Oh, the horror. In short, the formation of the new police was a response to the so-called Irish problem. And so it was fitting that to deal with this problem, you use the same methods you used in colonial Ireland. That is, colonial counterinsurgency forces. Dr. James Kay's ideas on the Irish in Manchester exemplify this thinking. The existing constable and watch system, Kay declared, had been fine when the population of England's towns was mostly English. But Kay claimed Irish populations required a different form of policing. He testified that, quote, expedients which might be efficient in restraining vice and preventing crime among a purely English population failed to produce these results in towns in which the English exist in great numbers. He continued, the defective state of the police in the large provincial towns of England had not been found to produce any serious inconvenience on account of the habits of obedience to law, which the English people have formed. But when large bodies of Irish of less orderly habits and far more prone to use violence settled permanently in these towns, you need something new. And Kay and others promoted this idea of the new police. This, then, is why Peel and Rowan and other police reformers created the new police and why they modeled it after Ireland's colonial forces. While they certainly hoped to manage rising crime and disorder, specifically on their mind was the need to manage the fact of thousands of colonized peoples invading their putatively sacred metropolitan space. And so they created a police force that appeared like a military and used colonial tactics to deal with it. The racialization of crime and disorder is what brings the boomerang back. It's therefore fitting that my sample of arrests made by the London Metropolitan Police in the 1830s reveals that the Irish were disproportionately arrested. While Irish-born and children of Irish-born immigrants made up about 5.7% of London's population, the Irish often made up over 10% of all arrests on average, and at times constituted up to even more than that. The Irish, therefore, were arrested at double the rate than they should have been if they were not over-policed or if they were not Irish. Now, in other cities that developed a civil police force, from Manchester in England to New York or the southern city of Savannah, you'll find the very same logic, with some slight variations. And I'm happy to talk about that in the Q&A, but I want to jump ahead to discuss another wave of militarization to really dig deeper into this logic of the boomerang. And I want to do so by referring to the United States in the early 20th century. So let me talk about this. It really exemplifies some important things. Now, why policing in the U.S. in the early 20th century? This was, in fact, a formative moment for policing in the U.S. It's often called the reform era or the modernization of policing. If you look at textbooks, history textbooks, policing textbooks, you'll see they refer to this period as the sort of modernization period. Now, prior to this period, police departments across the country had already been created along the London model, but around the turn of the 20th century, some important new developments unfolded. Police departments professionalized, rationalized, and more importantly, expanded their capabilities. They adopted new methods of criminal detection, they created new police training programs, they started training their forces in arms. They developed various specialized mobile squads to extend their reach. For instance, where most patrolmen only covered a small amount of territory, their own beats, previously. In this period, police departments began adding mounted patrols using horses, bicycles, and later motorcycles or cars in order to deploy more rapidly and cover more territory. Here's a photo of the mounted police squad in New York City. So for these reasons, this era is called the modernization era. Police essentially became more powerful than before, creating the powerful police departments that we know of today. But this, too, was an effect of the imperial boomerang. One of the leaders of this modernization movement was this guy, August Vollmer. He was the chief of police at the Berkeley Police Department starting in 1905. And he was the one who innovated most of these new police developments, from mounting police patrolmen to setting up the first police training school and so on. Vollmer is known for all of these things, which is why textbooks today refer to him as the father of modern policing. And if you go to the US and ask an everyday police officer on the street if they know August Vollmer, bets are they know who he is, they'll say, he's the father of modern police. Vollmer was a widely influential and important figure, in large part due to his innovations and reforms. And he went around and consulted with a lot of police departments, gave them new ideas for professionalization and so on. But note that Vollmer, before he became police chief, had been part of America's colonial empire. Specifically, he had served in America's largest colony at the time, the Philippines. For those of you who don't know, the U.S. had defeated the Spanish during the Spanish-American War of 1898 and then took the Philippines as its largest colony. Filipinos resisted. They had already suffered 300 years of Spanish rule, and they weren't about to suffer another 50 or more of Hollywood. This led to the Philippine-American War. And Vollmer had been involved in all of this. He had been in the army in 1898, fought the Spanish in the Philippines, and then, as part of the American occupying force in Manila, was among the few soldiers charged with policing the city of Manila. After this, Vollmer joined the American counterinsurgency efforts against the Filipino rebels. In fact, he was handpicked to join a brand new elite counterinsurgency unit charged with penetrating the jungles and interior of the Philippines to conquer and capture rebel leaders. That's up him in the upper right corner. This is from a photo from his papers. Now, only after all of this did Vollmer return to Berkeley and become chief of police in 1905. And he brought with him some of the colonial counterinsurgency techniques that he had been exposed to and used in the Philippines. His idea of mounting police forces, for instance, came partly from the American Army's counterinsurgency efforts in the interior of the Philippine archipelago. He also borrowed intelligence methods from the U.S. Army's counterinsurgency efforts to gather data and intelligence on Filipino insurgents. He also invented pin mapping. Now, Vollmer, in fact, is known as the innovator of pin mapping. This involves charting the location of crimes on a map in order to detect hotspots of criminal activity. So police departments started, you know, putting on the wall a huge map of the city and putting pins in the areas where crimes had occurred so they could know where the high crime areas are, and then they could direct their mounted police to those areas. Today, of course, this is called hotspot policing, predictive policing, spot mapping. It's so common that we almost take it for granted. This is Vollmer's survey of Minneapolis Police Department. He had a map of assaults, so these would be the hot spots where you see the dots. This is a New York City spot map of crime. It's just done today with computers and algorithms, so it's often called predictive policing, but it's the exact same idea. But Vollmer did not just make this up from thin air. He got it from his days in the Philippine-American War. The U.S. Army had, in fact, been the innovator of pin mapping techniques to track the movements of Filipino insurgents, locate their camps in the vast terrain of central Luzon, and embark upon their search and destroy missions. Vollmer simply applied this tactic to policing. He referred to it as the art of making war on the map, one of his lists of principles of policing. He later explained to police officers in Los Angeles that he got this beginning from his Spanish-American War days in the Philippines. He says, after all, we're conducting a war against the enemies of society, and we must never forget that. Notably, if you look at press discourse around this time in the early 20th century, this is the period in the US when the term war on crime begins. It doesn't begin in the 60s or 70s. It begins in the early 20th century in the wake of America's colonial empire and its violent colonial wars overseas. And in fact, other police forces brought back much more than pin mapping or mounted police units from the colonial scene. For example, in the 1910s and 1920s, some police across the country were discovered to be using a mode of torture to extract confessions called the water cure. An early variant of waterboarding, police tried to extract confessions from suspects by holding them down and pouring water down their throats. So this is police on largely African-American suspects. This, too, was an effect of empire. It had been the chosen mode of torture used by the U.S. Army in the Philippines during the Philippine-American War. It was also being reportedly used by U.S. forces in the 1910s during America's occupation of Haiti. No surprise that after this, you begin to see reports of police using the water here. So here again, we see the boomerang at work, right? The tactics come home. And here, too, racial logics were at work. So let me just clarify this before heading towards a conclusion. Just a little bit of U.S. history. In the early 20th century, cities across the country had seen an influx of new immigrants who were perceived as racialized threats to order. Consider the example I've been giving about Vollmer in California. Now, California had been excluding Asians from entering the U.S. because it was federal law, but many Chinese and Japanese immigrants still flowed in, and many migrated from rural areas to urban areas. And to many officials, these new immigrants and migrants were not the most welcoming sight. They claimed that they brought a rise in crime and a decay in public morality, and the specter of lawlessness and disorder emerged, such as with this image of the Chinese. Crime and disorder was thus racialized again, and in the eyes of authorities, a more powerful police was the way to deal with it. And more specifically, using tactics from the colonies was seen as the best way to deal with it. After all, those colonies were also filled with peoples racialized as inferior, as morally suspect, as having inherent tendencies towards vice and disorder. And so for white officials, it was perfectly appropriate and logical to import colonial methods for the purposes of domestic policing. And in fact, it was by this very logic that August Vollmer became police chief in the first place. Previously, in Berkeley and the neighboring Oakland community, there had been concerns about the increase of Chinese migrants from elsewhere in California. White publics had been especially appalled at the so-called Chinese gangsters and their opium dens that had been purportedly corrupting white morality and, worse yet, young white women. Here's one of many press periodical articles of the opium den. You see a priest saving the white women from the Chinese opium gangsters. The police don't have the power to do anything. They're tied up there, right? So in Oakland and Berkeley area, the white publics urged Vollmer to become police chief to help deal with this problem, exactly because of his experience in the Philippines, where, of course, he had already dealt with the so-called Oriental race. At the time, you know, they didn't have their racial logics worked out. Chinese were similar to Filipinos. They're all Asians. They're all Orientals. According to a newspaper account at the time, Vollmer's friends said to him about becoming police chief, "It will be a fighting job for whoever takes it. That's why we want you, Gus, August Vollmer. You were a pretty good fighting man when you went up against those goo-goos over in the islands." Goo-goos, of course, is the derogatory term for Asians. So again, perceived racialized threats summon the boomerang back. So with these two examples, let me head towards a conclusion. But before I do so, I want to bring it up to the present, or closer to the present, to just refer very briefly to more recent waves of militarization that I talk about in more detail elsewhere. I've only talked about two waves of militarization, but there have been others since then. Consider, for example, the development and spread of tactical units. These are heavily armed, small, mobile forces that the US and Britain developed in their colonies. Different from the regular force, they were specialized and elite, to be called out at a moment's notice. And by the 1950s, they had become the favorite policing unit for squashing protests and insurgencies, such as this unit in Hong Kong. These units then made their way to the US and Britain. For instance, they inspired the creation of tactical units across the US. Los Angeles SWAT team is a perfect example, but even before SWAT, there was the Tactical Patrol Force in New York City. As I discuss in my book, this was created in 1959, modeled after colonial tactical units, and it was created in response to a perceived racialized crime wave among so-called gangs consisting of Puerto Rican and black youth. This Tactical Patrol Force was later the same force that broke up the Columbia student protests against the Vietnam War in 1968. And also, that unit was renamed, essentially the same unit, it was the same unit that ended up suppressing the pro-Palestine protests at Columbia recently as well. In Britain, you have the same thing. This makes perfect sense. Tactical police units and military units had been prominent in the British Empire and had been an important resource for colonial regimes. Tactical policing units emerged in parts of British India after the First World War. They then spread to Singapore, while Northern Ireland later served as a site for further experimentation. By the 1970s, these units returned to London in the form of the Special Patrol Group, which was a response to the newly perceived racialized threat of post-Windrush immigrants. The Special Patrol Group, in fact, was part of a larger strategy of the British state, informed by new counterinsurgency theories developed across the British Empire, such as the counterinsurgency theories of the likes of Frank Kitson, who had cut his teeth in the colonies and in Northern Ireland. And they applied these tactics as they saturated the mostly black and Asian areas of London, and other units similarly did so across England's cities. They used roadblocks, surveillance tools, stops and searches, and military-style vans, all inspired by tactical units of the colonies, to surveil black populations and arrest them at disproportionate rates. This set the conditions for anti-police outrage and ultimately the urban unrest that we saw in the 1980s. Which in turn summoned more militarization and response. This is what I call the cycle of racialization, protest, and militarization. More recent years, we've only seen the continuation of this almost unstoppable process. Just look at what some scholars have called the paramilitary turn in British policing in the 1980s, by which the British police began employing the tactics and technologies of the Royal Hong Kong Police and Northern Ireland units. Writers like Jeremy Northam and Chris Williams have looked at some of this. Adam Elliott Cooper has fantastic work on British counterinsurgency and gang warfare in Britain. Much of this work shows how things like the gang databases used by the police are all imports from the imperial periphery. We might also note that the British police have intensified surveillance of Muslim populations using automated number plate recognition and CCTV cameras designed and maintained by the Olive Group, the company known for helping UK special forces in their surveillance operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. We might further point to the police killing of Jean-Charles Demenez in 2005 in London in the wake of the bombing attacks that occurred here. This was a shooting that was made possible, no police were indicted, because of new guidelines on police shoot-to-kill tactics, the so-called Operation Krakos guidelines, taken from where? Taken from the British Army practices in Northern Ireland and in consultation with Israeli forces operating in the occupied territories. There have also been a number of direct links in the United States between the US police and the Israeli state. Since the early 2000s, at least, police officers and police chiefs from various US towns, from very small towns to big cities, have traveled to Israel to observe and learn about so-called counterterrorism from the Israeli military and Israeli national police. Officers have gone to the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the border with Syria, and Israel's Municipal Police Academy to learn about intelligence gathering and various counterterrorism tactics. This has involved not just local police officers, but officers from the FBI and from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. I've looked at some of the documents, in fact, involved in this process and the training modules. It's very informative. Israeli officers teach the US police various tactics and intelligence gathering techniques, but they also teach more. They instill a racialized and ethno-religious counterinsurgency mindset that constructs Arabs, and particularly Muslim Arabs, as fundamental threats to peace and security. Without any qualification at all, they simply rehash the Orientalist stereotype that Muslims and especially Palestinian movements are a danger to be consistently surveyed and repressed. This then is the kind of stereotype that US police bring back to the US with them. And in this sense, it's not surprising that as this racist boomerang comes home, so does police repression of dissent, all under the assumption that student protesters are would-be terrorists. So let me finally conclude by returning to the puzzle with which I began. As noted, the civil police, theoretically, is for protecting citizens or domestic populations. Therefore, policing should be peaceful, indeed civil. The military colonial police, meanwhile, are aimed at repressing ostensibly inferior, irrational subjects and enemies, and thereby employ uncivil tools, i.e. violent militaristic methods. But the boomerang effect means that these boundaries are transgressed, domestic populations are treated like foreign aggressors or colonial subjects. It's not just that the police in the US and Britain are militarized, it's that there has been a slow and continual convergence in form and function between the policing of subjects abroad and domestic populations. But why? Why is it that the so-called civil police have come to treat domestic populations as if they are foreign enemies and colonial subjects, using some of the same means and methods that they use on the latter? Well, now that we understand the logic of the boomerang effect, the answer is plain. The civil police adopt militaristic colonial modes of coercion on domestic populations and treat those populations like colonial subjects because policing as an institution sees domestic populations as colonial subjects. They see them as inherently violent and inferior, unworthy of equal rights and treatment. And the primary modality for this categorical transformation, the key social code by which this miraculous transubstantiation of citizens into subjects occurs, is racialization. By racialization, domestic populations are constructed to be inferior, dangerous, and violent, just like colonized peoples. They are seen as subhuman specters, the dark criminal, the dark colonial subject, who encapsulate the white public's feverish fantasies of fear and horror. Racialization thus transfigures citizens and immigrants into, as Mbembe puts it in a different context, a menacing object from which one must be protected or escape, or which must simply be destroyed if it cannot be subdued. And this, in turn, not only warrants, but demands the importation of militarized tools, tactics, and technologies that had been originally deployed on colonized peoples in the first place. Our very racialized image of the criminal, I would argue, thus has colonial resonance, if not roots. Just as white settler colonial populations constructed colonized peoples as inherently violent and criminal due to their racial status, thereby warranting militarized policing in the colonies, so too do white publics and officials in America's or Britain's cities today call for and justify militarized policing of black and brown populations, many of whom are immigrants, based upon racialized assumptions of the latter's putatively criminal and violent tendencies. My last point follows. That is that this racialization is a Trojan horse to which we must be watchful. Racism is both the cause and modality of legitimation for bringing into the metropole, bringing into liberal democratic societies, militarized tools and tactics of policing. This is what I mean by racialization as the Trojan horse. It's the Trojan horse by which these tools and tactics, which we call policing, are brought from the peripheries to the metropole to be used on all members of society. For indeed, these tools of violence and repression that we call policing have been birthed in response to racialized colonized populations, but ultimately they are modular. Once integrated and institutionalized into society, they can be used on any and all populations, set up for use against society as a whole by would-be authoritarian or fascist regimes. And this, to conclude, my concluding point, I promise, this is why our struggles against authoritarianism or fascism or militarized policing must also be struggles against the ignorance of racialization and the temptations of colonialism. In other words, anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, and anti-racism should not be secondary or supplements to anti-authoritarianism or anti-fascism. They have to be integral components of them. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So we're going to... Thank you so much for a wonderful lecture, Julian. We're going to hear from Lavish for a few minutes to kind of reflect on the arguments here, and then we'll have some Q&A.
Absolutely. Can you hear me? I thought it would be better if I stand up. All right. Well, thank you to Julian for this fascinating talk, and really for all of your work over the last couple of years. Thank you to Aaron for arranging the LSE events team, as always, and all of you for being here today. I'm looking forward to a really generative conversation. I'm going to start with a small anecdote by way of introducing what I understand to be Julian's signature intellectual contribution, really what really is distinctive about his work. Because of course there has been a lot of work about policing, militarization, racialization, etc. The anecdote is this. The first time I met Julian was when he was a discussant on my paper, which was entitled Undisciplining Sociology. And we were there because we shared, it was a conference out of Beirut, and we were there because we shared a concern with challenging canonical closures in social theory that exclude and erase anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-imperial thought. And I also share with Julian an interest in tracing how techniques of violence are connected across history and geography, which is why I'm going to discuss it here today. From the talk this evening, I think it's very, very clear, and it's also a comment you made, Aaron, when you introduced Julian, undisciplining sociology is exactly the opposite of how Julian thinks or proposes that we confront some of these closures in canonical social theory or in work on policing and militarism. What struck me then and again tonight is that Julian responds to closures that, for example, separate police militarization from histories of empire and colonialism, not by abandoning sociology, but by reworking its methods against the grain. And so Julian proceeded to critically engage my paper, and very generously, but he insisted that we give sociology a chance, that we bend and can bend its disciplinary methods to challenge historical erasures of empire, colonization, and race, and rapidly pluralize also the sociological canon, which is the other body of work, which he didn't talk about tonight, but has a lot of work in it. So in my opinion, it's this insistence in rigorous, grounded, social scientific, historical sociological method that I understand to really be Julian's most significant and crucial intellectual contribution. And so Julian, in recognition of that, I'm going to ask you some questions, also to open up the conversation this evening, that all in different ways have to do with the question of method. So the first relates to the category of the colonial and the imperial. Central to your argument is that the concept of the imperial boom is the concept of the imperial boomerang, which you return to. The idea that personnel, logics, and techniques of policing are historical imports from imperial adventurism abroad. And in this talk, much like your broader work, you have primarily focused on a very particular set of colonial imperial formation, I think. Those moments when men actually physically go abroad to serve the occupation of foreign territories, or when models once used out there are brought back over here. Robert Peel in Ireland or August Vollmer in the Philippines, for instance, and pin mapping and so on. Of course, there are other colonial and imperial formations, many of which are still alive and kicking today, like U.S. settler colonialism and 21st century U.S. imperialism, which I think is a very particular kind of formation. Both of these formations sometimes tend to disappear from view. We rarely remember in public debate that the U.S. remains a settler colony, and it functions still as an afterthought, or usually just brought in land recognition statements before academic talks like this one, primarily in the U.S. And 21st century U.S. empire, even under Trump, does not work only through direct and sustained territorial occupation. In fact, Trump is very much trying to not send boots on the ground in Iran. Even in the final years of the war in Afghanistan, during the Biden administration, boots on the ground increasingly consisted of third country nationals, not U.S. soldiers. There weren't the Robert Peels and August Vollmers, maybe on a very senior position a little bit, but the men who served under them were less and less actually present there. Military bases, bombing from the air, drones, and violence exercised through or with other sovereign intermediaries, like Israel and the Gulf states, means that this 21st century empire functions not like the British one or even the U.S. occupation of the Philippines. In a world in the shadow of Gaza, the ongoing bombing of Iran, and the breakdown of the liberal world order, one could argue, perhaps, that empire is no longer hiding. But I'm still convinced that a lot of imperial power, tactics, etc., circulate in unseen ways. And what does that mean? How do you kind of address that? So that leads me to my first question. Can your method, what you offer us, trace the imperial boomerang when empire today in particular, is designed to disappear from view? My second question has to do with the changing practice of domestic, or what we call domestic policing. So the work of policing and military, as you know very well, often takes place outside institutions that are normally associated with them. And I don't mean this in the very, very abstract way where a university professor is kind of like border police because you take roll call in class for the home office. I mean it instead also here in a more narrow and concrete way, like when private security companies take over the work of police and property, or like Stuart Schrader has shown us in a great book called Badges Without Borders, when police take on jobs as security consultants around the world. Some forms of policing don't need people at all. You kind of gesture to them in the talk, but for, you know, drones, algorithmic systems, and AI are sufficient. Central to these shifts out of formal public and state-controlled institutions led by recognizable individuals is the theme of opacity. The work of policing can become increasingly obscure, it can become harder to trace. So here again, I want to raise a methodological question. How does one trace the imperial boomerang when policing in some areas is increasingly opaque and dispersed? My final question, because sitting as we are in the UK, is inspired by Policing the Crisis, the very important doorstopper of the book that Stuart Hall wrote with his co-authors. So in this book, they argue that the heavy policing of black urban youth in the 1970s, and you had a picture up from the Brixton riots, which was one major example of that, it happened, you know, in the wake of a moral panic around mugging. But they argued that it had to be understood not as a racialization crisis, which is, I think, how you frame it here, but as a crisis of capitalism. The crisis was accompanied by a broader economic crisis, by the explosion of violence also in Northern Ireland, the growth of student militancy, the Black Power movement, and increasingly militant trade union activity. The incessant focus on mugging, they argue, was an attempt to locate the problem in a defined racialized community, black urban youth, rather than in capitalism itself. Black militants thought of the time, black power movements, also in the US, Huey Newton and others, also spoke of this heavy policing of black populations in similar ways. They argued, for example, that black urban youth was surplus labor, which would, when useful to capitalism, was A-okay, but when not, and when necessary to unemploy or disemploy, was necessary to police and repress. So black militancy at the time also speak of them as a revolutionary lump and proletariat. More recent studies of counter-terror legislation and policing of Muslim communities in Europe have made similar arguments. Intensified talk of dangerous Muslim immigrants takes place alongside policies of austerity across the continent after the 2008 financial crisis. And here you have again, rather than talking about the crisis in capitalism, the location of the problem in a defined racialized community instead. Now, capitalism, class, and economic crisis is admittedly not front and center in your talk. So in my final question, I want to probe your methodology. How does your tracing, the method that you offer us, of tracing people, logics, institutions, techniques, etc., challenge or complement Paul's account of racialized policing as an expression of capitalism's crisis? Or to put it more bluntly, where's class and where's capitalism in your understanding of imperial boomerang and the militarization of police? So I know these are really large questions, and so I just want to end by saying that I'm very fascinated by the methods that you've offered us. And of course, I'm sure everybody thought of various examples of stories that you've heard also in public debate. The one that came to my mind around BLM was the story of how the knee on the neck of a black men mirrored the knee on the neck of Palestinians by Israeli police and military. And what's so interesting about your method is, you know, when that story went public, there was a lot of pushback around it in the press, and insisted that somebody prove that this technique circulated rather than just claim it. And so methods like yours really help us solidify our understanding of how these techniques of violence circulate and help us reveal what power perhaps we'd rather have that be concealed. So if you don't have time to answer all of them, I would like you to at least reflect to us, I'd love to hear more, but how you get to the point where you can really say, this is a connection. Because when that argument was made by protesters, the knee was a connection, it's a massive pushback on it. What methodologically do you need in your work to say, here's a link, this one is robust, this is no coincidence? There's a point in your talk where you talk about where you say tactical units were inspired, and I thought, okay, there's so much in this inspired that needs to be unpacked. When is it a causality? When is it a connection? This is especially important. The far right will deny these connections, but even the left and anti-racist movements will claim it, but not necessarily have the critical tools to really prove it to those not already in agreement. So I'm grateful for what you've offered us, and I think we're all richer for it. Thank you.
Would you like to reflect briefly, or should we go to Q&A first?
Let's go to
Q&A
for the audience.
Yeah. So we have lots of time for questions. For those that would like to ask them, please raise your hands. We have wonderful helpers, stewards with mics. We'll get them to you. Maybe you could just say your name and if you have an affiliation, where you're coming from. Wonderful. Maybe we'll start down here at the front on this side, and then we'll get the second question. This hand at the back here, and then we'll come to you in a second.
My name's Freddie, and I'm a Year 12 student. I study history and politics and economics.
Right.
I study history and politics at LSE. And I was wondering, is the racialized criminality and police militarization, such as through the war on drugs in America, maybe if you look at Thatcher's oppression of industrial action in the 80s, would you say that that's kind of police militarization is a deliberate tool of the state to maintain capitalism and a racial hierarchy, or do you think it's like a subconscious development of kind of policing and police themselves? Because of its origins of colonialism.
Great. We'll get this and then.
My name's Dave, affiliated to the human race. I've got two questions. Firstly, it seems to me people in the third world are much more aware of the dynamics of repression than people in the industrialized West. I guess that's due to the nature of the middle class and capitalism and so on, but if you've got any ideas there, please. Secondly, you haven't really talked about the battle of ideas between the police themselves and the political establishments. You give the impression that it's the police that are driving the militarization of themselves. Is that really your view? Thanks.
Thank you both. We'll definitely we'll come back and get these questions in a minute. I'll allow Jimmy just to maybe reflect on that and anything you want to say to Marvish as well.
Yeah, thank you for those questions. Let me start, let's go backwards. Battle of ideas between police and politicians, who are the real drivers? That's a really important question. I didn't in the talk really theorize the relationship between politicians and officials. I think it just varies by cases. In some cases, police officials are doing these innovations themselves and bringing them in. Sometimes they're doing it at behest of politicians. I think that it's generally the case, and the cases I looked at, that there's some kind of general sense through politicians or the public that something needs to be done. You know, as I mentioned, it's usually in response to some kind of perceived crime wave, sometimes a moral panic, as we sort of say. And so there's a general sort of sense among the public and police that something needs to be done. And so politicians will push this, sometimes police will push it. Sometimes the police are very enterprising. And these days, police are very, calling predictive policing is, it's a way for software companies to sell this stuff. So there's a lot of branding, and the corporations are really important in the story too, from the gun corporations. So there's all these other actors involved, and it's not just politicians, it's the corporations. I think there's a convergence of forces, and then in each case, it's somewhat different. But definitely, you're right to point out how politicians are driving this. And also, I would add, there's a kind of companies that more recently are involved. But even in Ballmer's time, I mean, the gun companies were very interested in American police in the 20th century arming themselves with their guns. So, today this is happening with high tech companies coming out of the Middle East. So I think all these different actors are involved.
And these are very niche case. So thank you for that. So the other question about people in the third world seem to be more cognizant of militarized repression. I think generally the principle is that those who have been victims of militarized repression are definitely more cognizant of it. In the U.S., just to give one example, you know, when American publics were appalled at the picture of tanks on America's streets, black populations were just like, yeah, what are you so shocked at? Here in England, the miners' strike, right, white publics were shocked that the miners were being repressed with all these tactics, and black populations in England were like, yeah. Yeah. So I think you're right, there's something about standpoint and experience here that I take a lot from in my own work and sort of learning from and listening to victims of oppression. I think it's very informative for kind of sociology that I do, so thank you for that. The question about war on drugs and police officers, I mean, and capitalism kind of goes to Mother's question. If I take your question, let me put it this way. I think that racialization works in complex ways. I think there's plenty of police officers who don't think of themselves as racist and aren't racist in the traditional sense. And my argument is very much sociological. This is an institution and a set of practices that has forces sort of operating behind the backs of the actors. So police are doing this stuff, and we're doing this stuff today, I think, without even being cognizant of the colonial origins or the racialized origins. I think in the past it's easier and more clearly racist. I mean, the LAPD, when it was founded, had a bunch of Klux Klan members. I mean, the connections are very close. There's some close connections today, but I don't think I need police officers to be racist for my argument to hold. I think that this is an institution. It's about institutions. It's about entire systems that have embedded and ingrained in our society and that push us to act in certain ways that have these colonial origins and that have been shaped historically by racialization. But we don't need racialization today to militarize. It's happening and it's kind of, again, happening behind our back. So I think this is a complex sort of sociology of what I'm talking about. It's not about individual perceptions of biases at all. Right? I know you're asking that, but I think this is really important to think about and to recognize that I'm really talking about institutions. And I say this because I'm giving this talk to police officers who get madly offended when I talk about it. It's important to recognize that racism is not an attitude, it's not a perception. It is deeply institutionalized and it's deeply connected with capitalism, right? And so in a sense, to move to Bauer's question, in my book, capitalism is really prominent for some of the reasons Stuart Hall says, but just to give you one example, I mean, there's a reason why Irish immigrants are coming to England, because they're feeding the cotton economy, right? There's a reason why in the South, one of the first police departments happens in Savannah. That's because Savannah had become an important port for shipping cotton from the American South to Ireland. And so they needed Irish workers to come in and work the warehouses and load the stuff. And of course, they were using slave labor. So Savannah becomes the site where these populations become seen as this racialized fear. And of course, police repress them to control them when the racialized subproletariat is really how I think about it. The underpaid, the overworked, the racialized, the bottom of the hierarchy, when they are seen as threatening order, then the policing comes in and militarized policing comes in. So I think the dynamics of capital can help us understand a lot of the origins of this. And think about the other cities in England after London that have the first police departments: Manchester, Bristol, shipping ports, and Manchester manufacturing, right? And there's a whole chain in the 19th century. American slaves are picking cotton. It's being brought to Savannah and other ports. Irish and some other slave labor is loading them on ships. It's being sent across the Atlantic to England cities, where unloading the dock are Irish subproletarians. And then they are sending it to Manchester to be turned into cotton by who? Underpaid Irish workers. So there's a whole, in the 19th century, there's kind of transatlantic colonial cotton capitalism, as I call it, that structures this. And we can look at all these different moments and trace out the sort of capital logics and the circulations and really, I think, get a purchase on that. So thank you for that question. It allowed me to answer that because it's true. It's not
it's not prominent in my book. And just the question about, Hall is really interesting because he's really digging through the ways in which class and race are articulated. It's something I've been thinking about. I have some work on racial capitalism, which I found really informative. I've been doing that after my policing stuff. But I see, that we need to recognize capitalism as racialized, and we can't separate the two. And I always go back to Hall's point, race is the modality in which classes live. I think that we can say race is the modality in which class is policed, right? That class is always police, the underclass, lower class, as many police scholars have long told us. But what I would like to add to the conversation is to think about how race and class are sort of articulated in policing practices, and how the racialization is what prompts the militarization, not just the concerns about class repression. So there's a lot there. And then you have questions about method and tracing this stuff. I mean, this is where we have to do research. This is where we have to be, and where, in my case, historical research. I know the case about the knee, and I think it's pretty clear that, like many other cases, it's not really traceable, right, to this case, Israel. But many others are. And we know that because of the historical record, you'll have August Balmer say so. But you'll also, I did a lot of work in the art times, tracing up particular tactics, a lot of protest tactics I would trace. I looked at the colonial records in Kew, I looked at records in the British Library, I looked at the papers of all these police officials to sort of try to figure out where they're getting these innovations from. And sometimes they're saying exactly it's from the colonies. Sometimes they are from the colonies and they don't have to say it. When they create a special patrol group, for example, that's a unit that they are naming the tactical unit, which is the name for the policing unit. So you can trace it by people, personnel, you can trace it by their own discourse, you can trace it by the way in which they're talking about it as well. Not all policing techniques and tactics are from the imperial peripheries, but those that are, I think we can trace them out. That makes it all the more difficult to do research today. I think when you talk about, I think that's the work of journalists, for example, this great book by Lowenstein, The Palestinian Laboratory. People on the ground are able to see things that I, as a researcher, can't unless we go into the field. So militarization today, the boomerang effect today, the circulation of these tools and tactics, I think, requires careful ethnographic work. It requires careful work of people on the ground to really trace out these connections. When I think about historical causes, I really restrict myself to where I feel like I can establish that this is really brought in from the colonies, and the cases I've given you are the clearest ones.
Thank you. So we have three questions that I wanted to grab here. We have one at the front, and then there was a kind of combined pair in the middle here. And we're then going to do those three, and then we've got three online. If we have more time, we'll try and come over here as well. So maybe we'll start, down at the front here, and then, Prophet, would you put your hand up so they can... Yeah, so, and then these two over there.
Hello. Thank you for today's presentation. My name is Owen Markham. I'm a PhD student at KCL, my affiliations. So my question is kind of in the vein of some of the other questions that have been asked, but is your kind of theory or kind of what you've been saying, or do you have anything extra to add about kind of policing within kind of post-colonial states, decolonization creates a world of independent nation states, and I think the foundational part of any nation state is a police force, So do you have sort of any additional things to say about, say, a former colony like Nigeria? Is there in their policing any different? Do you have any sort of additional comments to add? Because, I imagine there's levels of militarization, but, how does that differ kind of from us, the imperial metropole?
Great. And then we'll do this today.
Thank you. I know that you spoke directly about, obviously, racialization as this core logic that's necessary for militarized policing. But I'm wondering as well what you think of the use of technology in these data-driven policing strategies that present what is inherently racialized data as objective in its essence, as kind of like this de-racialization and policing legitimization tactic, as the public is becoming increasingly conscious about the more overt forms of racialization and structural inequality.
Got a list of countries that were once colonized, the Philippines, Vietnam, Ireland, and Hong Kong. Isn't it more a pathological reaction to the defeats that these colonial police face and as we can see, I don't think really that is a post-colonial, but more the neo-colonial reaction to the fact that basically that the policing that was going on in the colonized imperial world at the time has been defeated by what we now know we call asymmetrical reactions to these colonial, this sort of colonial oppression. Why don't you just call it a pathological reaction to these defeats against colonialism?
Okay, so we'll take these two questions and then hopefully have a little bit of time to get to some of these ones from the online too.
Yeah, thank you for all those questions. I'm going to tell you, I see kind of two questions about sort of so-called post-colonial and neo-colonial states. So the policing so-called post-colonial regimes, and I know a little about the Philippines, I know about some of the cases, but I think that what you see when you trace out these histories is exactly the legacy of the colonial period of policing. All of these techniques and tactics and the modern militarized policing was the norm in the colonies for various reasons. And over time, that norm becomes institutionalized deeply into the apparatus of the state. Partly because in the colonies, to man the police forces, they bring in colonized populations, of course, just like the army, you know, did. And secondly, the army and the police in the colonies are, you know, they're really in, almost indistinct. And so you have the whole history of colonial insurgency and suppression leading to the creation of these heavily militarized forces that then kind of persist. And in the Philippines case, precisely, the people that set up the police forces are American officials when they decolonize, and the people who had been for the military, the locals, and people who have been already trained in this kind of colonial counterinsurgency policing. So that legacy persists into the present. And that's why I wouldn't say it's pathological. I say this is a pathological, to me, just it's unsociological, so I can't, as a sociologist, I don't want it. Makes it sound kind of normal. But I think we have to realize that this is the normal operations of the state apparatus in the post-colony. Capitalism is its most extreme and violent. So that's how I would characterize that. It is sort of each colony has its own history, so I don't want to reduce them all. But I do think we have to remember the history of colonialism and the way in which state violence and state oppression was so crucial for it, and the way in which it functioned very differently than the civil police here. And that's what's so terrifying about this research. When I started and came to see this, I began to see a convergence between the two, and that really is kind of at the heart of what I'm talking about, and really got me wondering about how could this be happening. And so it's the convergence that's really interesting. The tech-driven data, I mean, I think you answered your own question, because I heard you say that the data is already racially biased, so that would be my answer, right? I mean, technology runs around and data runs around as it's objective. It is not. And you see this, you know, when the LA Police Department first collects all of its crime statistics, guess what? They're collecting it because they're only patrolling those areas where they are finding crime and searching for it. And guess what? Those areas are the heavily racialized areas. So over time, over decades, you collect all this data and you look at the data today, you say, where's the crime been and where is it? And where should we send more police? Of course, it's in the racialized areas. You know, the Chicago police don't storm the dorms of my university looking for cocaine. And they did it in the early 20th century, right? So the data we have is already racially biased. And, you know, I don't want to discount quantitative sociology saying this about this, but, you know, I think we have to be skeptical of this kind of data propaganda. I'm not saying data is always bad, but we have to be very skeptical, very fucking skeptical. Especially when these solutions, they're posed as solutions to social problems. So I think it just means we have to be aware of the biases. And I think police and scholars are beginning to realize how biased the data that the police use. Right? And they say, even in England in the early 70s and 80s, they were the police in London and elsewhere in Brixton, they were accused of being racist and going into the racist areas. What did they say? Well, the data proves that these are areas where the most crime is. Well, how is that data collected? And why was it collected? So, right, there's a history of data collection that I think we need to study better. And this is the top task for historical sociologists, so any PhD students, thesis students, this is stuff that we need more of to really understand how historically data is collected and accumulated and how it contains biases, which doesn't mean that they're useless, but it means we have to be very careful. So all of this predictive stuff, all of the AI stuff, it relies on this bias data.
Let me take these three from online questions that we've received from people that are joining online, so we thank them. We have Gloria Mack, another Year 12 student, Year 12 then, I think. Do you think the militarization of policing contributes to a period of economic stagnation? And if so, why and how? We have an anonymous question, which is, where do you see the future of police militarization in the UK? Are we on the verge of an ISIS-like crackdown here? And then finally, Vijay Shrau, what role does propaganda play in terms of stories around policing? So we have maybe just 2 minutes before we need to wrap up.
Deal with all three of us.
Okay. 40 seconds each.
Yeah. Go for it. Okay, what's the future policing? I don't know. I don't know. But just let's say I didn't sleep at night worrying about that. So I should listen. I don't know about the policing. I think it's a good empirical question to address. How does policing impact economic stagnation, if at all? I'm inclined to think that it's really economic stagnation that leads to more and more policing. And that's definitely the way it is in the United States. I'm trying to get this in 2 minutes. The last question was, what was the last
question? What was propaganda?
Oh, this is Elliot's question, because I have my colleague and some others, Robert Vargas, he's doing all this work called copaganda. And in the United States, the police unions are some of the the only unions that I'm skeptical of are the police unions in the United States. They have massive power, they collect donations, they have massive propaganda machines. They contribute to creating, whenever there's a blue police, like I watch what happens in New York with Mondale, whenever a Democrat official comes and talks about doing anything to the police, they mobilize, they create all this propaganda. Like in Chicago, when Brandon Johnson was elected, there was suddenly a scare of shoplifting. And everyone was scared of shoplifting. And it was clear that the police are, you know, promoting these statistics to say, you need us, and you don't defund us, don't defund, you need us. And so they create these scares. It's very deliberate, targeted, and it's very cynical. And it really, really disappoints me. But it's something to really be careful of. And copaganda, I think that's a perfect word for it.
Yeah. Thank you again to Professor Garo, Professor Ahmed. Thank you for your questions. We really appreciate your contributions this evening. Thank you to the organisers, the students that have helped us run the event tonight. But maybe just join me in thanking our speakers one more time.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.